But at the time, Peter was like 22 years old. He was the only young person who actually came to Maharishi at that time. Maharishi saw in him the potential for the young people of the Western world to pick up meditation. So Maharishi figured, through Peter, I'm going to some way influence the Western world. And it did happen that way, through Peter. It was Peter who introduced Maharishi to Keith, and then started getting lots and lots of college students meditating. And there was a huge wave in the West, which is picking up every year. Right now, more people practice yoga than attend church in the Western world. There is an absolutely huge, 2/3 of people in the United States consider an alternative doctor to be their primary physician. There's an absolutely huge and unstoppable movement now of all things Indian being introduced to the Western world, and we're the better off for it. But anyway, the person who was right in the sort of beginning of the whole thing was Peter Waltz. So he's going to answer any questions and kind of tell us his story of what happened with Maharishi. So Peter Waltz. Peter also has a fantastic art collection. We should do a field trip to his apartment.
You're welcome.
Tonight at midnight. We're dropping on him.
You could check out my PJs.
Which I did 2 nights ago.
You mean not check out my PJs, but visit my art collection.
No, vice versa. When the
oh, when the alarm went off.
Then the alarm went off in our building. It was the middle of the night, at least for me. And I'm like, hey, Peter, how you doing? I was in my PJs.
Yeah, and I was talking with a Purusha guy who should have been asleep but was staying up talking about esoteric things, of course. I think, you know, this is a fairly young class, and so I'd like to start a little bit with my own feelings when I was your age. Not your age, but the, you know, that when I was about 20 and so on, I was living in Paris. And just quickly, I didn't believe that there could be such a thing as freedom. I think that everybody was kind of programmed. We see that more and more. Your cell phone follows you around everywhere you go, and marketing and politics is all based on some sort of hypnotic, you know, imposition on your free thinking. And I remember talking to Maharishi late one night in Rishikesh, and somebody who was there said, what is hypnotism? Is it like meditation, Maharishi? And he said, no. He said, it's the very opposite. The very opposite. And I thought, oh, that's what I thought, you know. He said, and he answered my question then about freedom, about how you could be a free individual, how you could live a free life, how you could make decisions based on what you wanted and what you felt was the right thing, and how millions and billions of dollars are spent every year to try to get you to think a certain way, to buy a certain product, to vote for a certain person, and like that. And are we really free? And can we be free with only using a certain percentage of our mind? And so one of our early posters for SIMS, Students International Meditation Society, was expand your conscious mind. And the idea was, and we were more like revolutionaries than we were religious people or anything like that. We felt that the world was pretty well programmed. The man in the gray flannel suit was sort of the enemy of the beatniks, and the hippies were just starting off. And the gray flannel suit was the man who programmed everybody, who was Madison Avenue, who gave you, you know, buy the red box with the soap in it because it's better, it works better, and, you know, and vote for so-and-so, you know, spend $20 billion on telling you something like that. And so, you know, and I knew from my reading and so on that it was easy to program people. In fact, Aldous Huxley, who was kind of, I was a fan of him in when I lived in Paris in the early days, when I was about 18. And I loved him, but he spoke to Berkeley and he said, you know, 80% of the human beings are easy to program. Now that was in 1940. It was just, I didn't hear the speech because it was to the faculty, and it was way before I was about 3 years old when he gave the speech. But at that time, Hitler and Mussolini were taking over Europe, and people were wondering, how can people go so crazy? How can they fall into this belief system? You know, that they need, that, you know, what is it about them? And Huxley said, if you repeat something enough, you know, like we're going to be attacked, or the weapons of mass destruction, or anything like that, people will start believing it. You know, and so the idea is, when I was young, you know, it was, could you have a free mind? Could you be free to think and be an individual, or are you going to be subject to programming? Marshy's answer to that question was beautiful. He said that the weaker mind is overpowered by the more powerful mind. There was just a guy in Russia. He was a big heavy man, and he would go into the banks and he would say, "I need money. Give me all your money." And he would hypnotize the people. And this lady in line said, "I don't know what happened to my life savings. It's gone." You know, they were interviewing the people in the line. This was in Sevastopol, Russia, or something like that. I just read it. Anyway, it's this overpowering of people's intelligence and so on that robs them of their freedom, really. And then they become just acting like that. So Marshy said it's the more powerful mind and so how can you be free? You have to have deeper level of consciousness. And what is the levels of consciousness? And this is Vedic science, so you know all about what the levels of consciousness are and so on. But the very subtlest level of consciousness is the goal of human life. It's the most wonderful thing ever. And it was the name of this great saint that Maharshi allowed me to see. And it was a friend of Gurudev's. And this saint was called Ananda Mai Ma. And so Ananda Mai, Maya is relative reality. Ananda is the subtlest level of all the Prakritis. It's the very subtlest form. So it's the goal of all human beings to live in bliss. To really, it's your birthright. It's something you can breathe in and breathe out. It is your birthright. And what do we have? We have this school which is trying to return your birthright to you. Not trying, but actually doing it in a very beautiful way with Maharshi's teaching. And the teaching is that yoga staha kuru karmani, established in yoga, established in the finest field of relativity. And you have so much to look forward to, so many techniques. Vedic science means Maharshi has this complete thing so that every level is taken care of. You have advanced techniques, you have the cities program, you have most beautiful things, you have becoming a teacher, meditation. I became a teacher in the late 60s, and teaching meditation was, to me, it was connecting with the holy tradition. It was like not only being on that Anandamaya level in my meditation, but also acting on that level. Because when a person starts meditation, it isn't really the teacher that Maharshi trained so much that is to be responsible, but it's this tradition of masters that went, starting with Maharshi, going back to Gurudev, you know, Vishistha, all of the great masters, you know, Yogendra, all of these, Sukadev, everybody in this tradition. When you're taught, you know, they do the puja. When you're taught meditation, do the puja. And the teacher of the puja mentions everybody's name in this holy tradition. So it's magic. It's very magical because, actually, it's very scientific. It's Vedic science. Because what happens is the teacher, as humble as he might be, as young as he might be, and so on, is able to put the student in contact with this tradition. And I never thought in all my life that I was out of contact with that tradition. I live it, I breathe it. It's my birthright. And it's the path to Anandamaya. The happiest person I ever met in my life was Maharshi. When he was young and still had mostly a black beard and a lot of hair, he was laughing all the time. All the time. And I took care of the door in Rishikesh, so people would come to see him, very important people. It might be, you know, the head general of the Air Force. It might be the head of all Indian culture, the head of the, you know, the radio and everything. And they would come and they would visit him in Rishikesh, and I would be on the door so that, that, you know, that he had to see, he could see people privately, and then I would wait and talk with him out there. And I heard his laughter all day long, every day, and it never stopped. He was just so full of bliss. And for 4 or 5 months before I came to Rishikesh, I had been with Anandamayi Ma, and I had experienced every day this thing they call darshan. I don't know if you've heard of it, but it's just when a saint blesses you. And some days I could have darshan, and some days I couldn't, but it is like a combination of an atomic bomb going off and your heart exploding in love. It's just the most beautiful, beautiful thing. And it lasts, one darshan will last for weeks, 2 weeks. You'll be in God consciousness, just, you've heard of all that, of how, you know, you can have just your heart full of love. And it, to me, I couldn't describe it except for, it's like if you had a desire, like just some small thing, it could be anything, like, oh, I'm thirsty. It would be at the time that you were, say, biting into a tangerine that was peeled, of course. And so you never had that gap between wanting and receiving. You lived in this sort of, in English I could only think it would be like a state of grace where you you just were just blessed continuously. And so that was the darshan of Ma. But there were times in those 4 or 5 months that we traveled in a small group all over India. And that was such an excellent thing, because everybody would like to travel with Ma, but only some of the great sannyasis, the Dande sannyasis that had been with Gurudev, and some other great people. And then she would go to different places, and then even the mayors and everything of Calcutta and Bombay and everything would come to visit her, and they all bowed down. Indira Gandhi bowed down. Everybody bowed down, because you could see by looking at her, going through the train station in New Delhi, in Bombay. I remember a man, very well-dressed man, and his pants were a little dirty from falling on the ground. And he grabbed my coat and he said, who is that? And you know, I was an American. Why would he come to me? You know, why wouldn't he go to somebody who would be more knowledgeable? But obviously I was traveling in this entourage, and I just said, that's Anandamayi Ma. And it changed his whole life. For just seeing her changed his whole life. He became a devotee, and Anandamaya is your birthright. It is not a person. It is not a saint. You are a saint. You are the saint. And you contact that bliss, and that's your natural state. And you live as, you know, do you believe in God? It's hard not to believe in God when you have these experiences, because you feel blessed and you know you're blessed, and it's more real than anything that the world can offer you. It's real, it's unshakable. It is your essence. It is your soul. And so what we have here is a room full of souls with bodies. And the lovely, lovely souls. It almost feels like, what can I say, like a family reunion. who knows? I mean, we're, you know, we come in this world, we're just, we're all friends. It's not, you know, one's better than the other or anything like that. It's just that we're, you know, you could be my cousin, you could be, you know, my niece or something. You could be, you know, somebody that's in my family, you know, a brother. And a big family reunion, maybe a very big family reunion. And that is the souls which are immortal, which go through many experiences. And the experiences can seem sometimes like suffering, and they can seem sometimes like just the most priceless gift that could ever be bestowed on you. And it's the soul that brings on everything. It's the, what do you say, the karma, and it's the intelligence and so on. So that somebody over here might be living in a melodrama, and somebody over here might be living in spiritual ecstasy. But they still have the same potential, they still have the same nervous system. And each of these techniques, these advanced techniques that are so important, and these cities that are so important, and teacher training, which is so wonderful when it puts you in contact, where you can actually bring other people, it's a sort of a privilege to bring other people to this state of Anandamaya. So anyway, after I was sent to Maharshi, after about 4 or 5 months with Anandamaya Ma, you know, he asked me a lot of questions and things like that, and he wanted to check my meditation, which was, so I'd been practicing Zen Buddhism, and then I'd been practicing this technique from India that was from an ancient tradition of Babaji and Lahiri Messiah and Yogananda and everything, and that technique... Does anybody have a Kleenex around here? I don't really need it. I'll just... this technique I practice is very difficult. Thank you so much. Can you get one of those out? And it was very difficult and very complicated. And I had mastered it. And when I first met Maharshi, you have to know that I was living with a sannyasi at my parents' house. They had a big house, so there was room for an extra sannyasi or so. And so, with my other brothers. And I was practicing like 12 hours of meditation a day, some days, and some days we were singing for hours. We were doing bhajan, you know, singing of devotional songs and so on. And sometimes we were visiting saints. And there were saints in the Hopi tribe, and there were saints in Hawaii, the Kahuna, old man David Bray, and there were lots of saints in Los Angeles that had studied with different gurus, you know, Vivekananda, Yogananda, and so on like that. Beautiful intellectual people, and so on like that. So one day, this sannyasi who was living with us, Swami Nirmalananda, was named after Anandamaya Ma. And had been with Anandamaya Ma in India. So one day he says, oh, look, a great saint from the Himalayas is coming. He's arriving in Los Angeles airport, you know, in 2 days. We should go, you know. And I said, yeah, I'd love to meet this. And this was in 62. And so we go out the door and get to down to Los Angeles airport, and we're waiting there. And there's some people that I would call old, but they were yet much younger than I am now, probably. So which goes to show you the way things work. But they were standing on one side, and we were standing at the other, and they were looking across. And of course, this tall man with the orange robes was standing with us, and we were young, and they were seemingly older. And so you know, they're thinking, you know, Charlie Lutz and Mrs. Olson and so on. They're thinking, are these people here also to see Maharshi? You know, we haven't seen them before. Where are they coming from, you know? And Maharshi came out, and we were overwhelmed. That's the first time I saw him. And we were just overwhelmed. And I had not been, you know, in the presence of such a great saint ever before. And so the sannyasi just laid down flat on the ground, just flat at the feet of Maharshi. And my brother and I bowed down very low, you know, touching the ground. And that was the first time we saw him. But I tell you what was wrong was the message was a little bit like weak for me. I mean, 20 minutes twice a day. Here I was, you know, practically sleeping while I was meditating. You know, I mean not asleep, but I practically didn't sleep. I just was meditating all the time. And so, and we're singing devotional songs, and we had a real Vedic lifestyle going. And 20 minutes twice a day didn't really seem like it was going to be, you know. So we loved the saint, but it didn't register. And then I had this experience, which Tom knows about, which just was like this blessing. And I guess now it came from Maharshi, but he never liked to give blessings. He always did. He couldn't help it. But he wanted us to go within ourselves. And after living with Anandamayi Maa for 4 or 5 months, I said to myself, you know, oh, she's going into silence now. I would really like to have her darshan all the time. I would not like to just be the physical proximity, having that take away from me the ability to have darshan. I would like to find her within my heart, you know. And so that is in fact what happened, because at the time that she was going into silence, she sent me to Rishikesh, to Maharshi. And that's just just done in several ways. People, Brahmachari, brought me a note. Other people gave me messages from Ma and things like that. And I just went. I just walked out onto the street in Hardwar, and the car stopped. And yes, where are you going? And I said, oh, I'm going to Rishikesh. Yes, come. Where are you going? And it wasn't even a moment's wait. I didn't even have to have time to think about it. Am I going to get a ride, or how am I going to get there? Just boom, happened like that. And I got to Rishikesh, and it was pretty late at night. You know, it was starting to get dark, dusk, and the boats had stopped crossing the river and everything. So I went, and I there was this ashram there called Swami Shivananda, and he was very famous, and he was known by Gurudev. He was known by Anandamayi Maa and so on. He was a very big man who sang with a very deep voice, Shri Ganesh, Shri Ganesh, Shri Ganesh, Shaparvati. But he had passed away the year before, so there was a young man there, and he was Swami Chidananda, and he just kind of embraced me, and we just sort of talked all night long. And he said, you really should stay in this ashram. This is perfect for you and everything. And I said, no, I've been sent by Ma to see Maharshi. And he said, oh, he's not here. He hasn't been here for 2 years, and we don't expect him. And, if he was coming, I would know, because I'm the head of this ashram, and this is the biggest ashram. And I would never not know that he was coming. So I said, yes, it's all right. But, you know, he said, you should really stay here. And I really had a feeling, you know, he was so wonderful and charming. But I knew I had to go. So the next morning he arranged for a boat to take me across the Ganges. And it was so beautiful. And then I walked for a mile or a mile and a half down the side of the Ganges, past all the ashrams where the saints were, the Rishikesh, you know, the caves of the Rishis. And they would come there, and all the pilgrims would come there and everything. And I went past that onto the sand, and then just into the wilderness. And then there was a little sign that said Shankaracharya Nagar, and it was both in Devanagari and in English.
Well, that could be the final exam for this class.
I think you should just let them off easy. So. Being a Sanskrit student myself is very difficult, so I had compassion. But anyway, so what happened was, I got up and I went up to the side of this mountain, Shankaracharya Nagar, and I got there, and there was some people there in the kitchen, and they said, no, Maharshi hasn't been here for a long time, years, you know, we don't expect him, we have no news. We would know if he was coming, you know. And so I said, okay, that's fine. I said, but I know I'm supposed to be here, so can I just sit on this big rock, you know? And they said, oh, yes, you come. We'll bring you some fruit, we'll bring you some water. Before I even got the fruit, you know, this car pulls out of the jungle, and it's like a little Fiat, you know, one of those white little Fiats. And turned out that my best friend ever was driving that car. It was Brahmachari Devendra, and he had a big bushy hair and big bushy beard, and he had eyes like pinholes, like Bodhidharma, you know. And he was like, his face was in this windshield, and you're just like. And then sitting next to him, a little bit diminished by his size, was Maharshi, and so. Maharshi just gets out and he looks over at the rock where I'm sitting. He says, yes, yes, come. And I, you know, it's like, it's okay, I'm ready. And he had come there to go through his 2 weeks of silence, which he does every year, and it's usually around the first part of the year. And so I didn't know that, but I was invited in, and there was one other Westerner that was there that we were so relieved when he left. It was just, oh, God, this man from Finland. It was a journalist. And, you know, when he left, he stuck out his hand at Maharshi, and he says, I've met a lot of people that claim to be saints, but he says, you're the first real man that I've met, you know. And he and Maharshi looks, sitting on the bed, you know, looking at him, and he puts out his hand to shake it, and Maharshi puts his hand out like that and shakes him. He leaves. And then we just sat in silence for a long time. And then we sort of both went, phew. And because I'd been with Anandamayi Ma, I'd never seen, you know, saints treated like that. But Maharshi had to go through a lot of stuff because he was traveling around the world. And so, but saints are always treated with great devotion and great, you know, great sensitivity. And so anyway, after a while, he said, so, you know, tell me about your thing. And he wanted to hear about Ma, you know, and he knew Ma. And I was surprised. That's the first time I heard that he knew Ma, you know. I knew Ma had sent me to Maharshi, but I didn't know if it was just some mystical perception that she was going to have him become my guru or something. I couldn't tell, you know. But she had visited Gurudev many times, and Gurudev had been very, you know, visited her, and they were very good friends, saints, and without flawless saints, just born as you know, on the level of perfection. And so so anyway, I told him about her and everything, and then it was something cute that happened. He said, so why did you come here? You know, why did you come here? And I said, she went into silence. So, and I, you know, forgot to tell him that she told me to come there. So it's just that she went into silence. He says, oh, I see. He said, she went into silence, and so you came to see me. And I was mortified, and then he started laughing, you know. And then he showed me a side of himself, which I didn't see that often. It was very, very infrequent, but he gave me darshan, which was very powerful. And it was the same darshan that I had received from Ma. And then I knew there that what was, why things were the way they were, because he taught TM, he didn't want to be a saint that was known for blessing people because they could bless themselves, you know. And in fact, he made that very clear over the years when other saints would visit and so on. And he would just show them how his students, who were so beautifully dressed and so wonderful and so on, were already blessed. They had gone within, deep within, and reached that level of Anandamaya, and even beyond that, transcended it and come back out into that many, many times. And so they were far, vastly advanced. So advanced that something that nobody very rarely ever got in terms of being you know, a yogi and doing sadhana, you had to be at the most advanced level of yoga to receive the Patanjali's Yoga Sutras. That was beyond most saints' ability. And even Swami Sivananda, who was a giant saint, when people would come and ask them, saints would come, not just people, but real saints would come, and they'd say, I want to learn the cities now. And he would say, no, I can't teach the city. Only Gurudev can teach the city, Swami Saraswati Brahmananda, the of Jyotirmath, the Maharishi's Gurudev. So he just basically would send them to Gurudev. It was so advanced. And even when I've been in India and seen saints that were completely enlightened but needed some refining on the level of unity consciousness, I've seen them come to Maharishi. And it wasn't a decision that Maharishi had to make that, yes, I'll teach this guy or something. It was nature. It was just the force of nature that said, this yogi, this sannyasi, has reached this level of development, and now he needs this knowledge. Who in the world can give it to him? Well, Gurudev's disciplehood absorbed all the knowledge of Gurudev. And so that would be the opportunity. They would come together, and Maharishi would teach him these advanced techniques that are just amazing things. And these would be full-blown-out saints that were famous all over India. And it would be done in private, in the dark of night. And sometimes Maharishi would give me the flashlight and let me hold it. And we'd go off into the jungle, and then he'd say, just, you know, stand back there, but don't say anything, and don't turn on the flashlight. And I would stand back there. And then these great saints that were just famous everywhere, you know, just powerhouses, would come, and Maharishi would teach them some technique or something, just, and then they would go off. Just to stimulate some part of their body or something, just something they needed, that he had the knowledge for, and that he had absorbed from Gurudev. So Sivananda couldn't do it. Even though he was a great saint, he didn't have the full knowledge of the holy tradition. It sounds like the holy tradition, you know, it just sounds like, oh, it's another holy tradition or something like that. But it is, in fact, the history of Vedic science. It is the history of the whole creation, you know, starting with Narayan and Brahman and so on, and going on to each great teacher, and mentioning the name of each great teacher. So it's when you become a teacher of TM, you actually become part of that tradition. And it's hard to perceive how great it is and what a gift it is and how powerful it is, how people get, when they start meditation, they just all of a sudden become full, whole, like that. So I don't know if there are any questions or anything, but yes.
I just have one question. Who was in the cave with you
tonight? Well, after about 3 months, Maharishi, I came to Maharishi's house, and I said, there's nobody waiting out here at this time, Maharishi. And I had come for initiation many, many times, but he just put it off. And so in this situation, this day, he said, where are your fruits and flowers? And I thought, oh my gosh, I'm going to have this initiation. So I said, I didn't want to, you know, say, well, I can get them on Tuesday or something like that. So I said, oh, they're just outside, you know, thinking, what am I going to do? And this tree that was in front of his little bungalow had beautiful flowers all in it. And I hadn't really noticed them before. And the man from the kitchen was just walking by. And I said, please wash me some fruits quickly. And I picked the flowers. And I had everything else because other things didn't spoil. And I just was in quickly. And he initiated me. And then he said, you know that cave by the Ganges? And it was a special cave that that actually was supposed to be his cave for going into long meditations and things like that. And later he did. Glad that's not mine.
That's all right.
And so I was afraid. I said, should I bring my phone? And then I thought, no, it might ring, you know. And then, but it was yours instead, so it's all right. So I said, yes, I know the cave, Marshi. He says, well, I want you to go there and meditate. I said, very good, very good. So he finished doing the puja, and and everything. I started to go out the door, and he said, I turned and I said, I wonder how long he wants me to meditate for. I didn't really care, but I didn't want to overdo it or underdo it. I just wanted to have the instruction. And so he said, no, no, just meditate. And this cave was an unusual cave because it had a stairway going down to it, so it was very dark. You could then go around this thing, and then you go into this, like a room. It was really right on the edge of the Ganges, but it had been built to be especially dark and especially remote. And so, I guess because Maharishi wasn't using it yet, there were other saints in there. And when I went in, I said, how long shall I meditate? He said, no, no, just meditate. So I started to leave, and then he said, oh, you could, if you feel tired, you could rest, you know. And I thought, oh, yeah, okay. And then he said, oh, and if you're hungry, you could have some fruits or something like that. I said, oh, okay, like that. So for 3 weeks, I was in this cave. But when I went in, when I first went in, I couldn't see anything. You know, I couldn't see my hand. I held my hand up like this, and I thought, now, if there's one photon of light in this cave, I could see my hand, and I couldn't. You know, there was nothing I could see. So, but there was some noise and stuff, a little bit of noise, and then I said, hello, you know, and they said, yes, yes, who are you, what are you doing here, you know, and I said, oh, Marshi sent me here, he wanted me to meditate here. Oh, and I thought, well, you know, it's okay, you can share, you can stay here, you know, he says, no, 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 Marshi wants you to meditate, he wants you to meditate here. So what was just some breathing initially became people, and then it became, you know, then they left. They all left, and they all went to other caves, I guess. And so I was alone in this cave, and, you know, I didn't have to see anything because my eyes were closed anyway the whole time, and so I just started transcending, and oh, you know, Marshi checked my meditation from what I had learned when I was practicing Kriya Yoga, and he was very impressed. At least he seemed very impressed. He went, "Oh, you really have that, you know?" And I thought, "Oh my gosh, you know?" Because I was sitting in this little room and I did this Kriya Yoga, and it felt like the whole room lit up, you know. And so doing it in front of Marshi was even better than, you know, doing it in some place. So anyway, the story is that I went so much deeper than even my techniques that I had learned, and I went so deep that I just I forgot even the mantra. I forgot everything. You know, and so when I came out, you know, probably in a week or so, I just couldn't imagine, you know, if I had the right mantra or anything. So I came out and the light was so bright and everything, and Marshi was just walking up and to tell somebody to do something or something, and I got along beside him and I said, Marshi, I'm not sure if I have remembered the mantra correctly. And he says, yes, yes, what is it? What do you just whisper in my ear? So I whispered, and he goes, yes, yes, go back. So I went back. And after about 3 weeks, I was totally transformed. And this, whenever I teach, And I've taught meditation for so many years that I can look at people that are on the faculty here and things like that, and they, you know, or people that are living near me or something. And I know I taught them, you know, in this part in that country, but this part of there and so. And it wasn't, you know, of course, it isn't me that taught them, but I happened to be the person that did the puja and gave them the mantra. But it was really the holy tradition, thank God, you know, that I had this incredible authority behind me to be able to, because they always got it. They always got it 100%, you know. And so anyway, I just went to Marshy after 3 weeks and I said, you know, this is what I always used to tell people when I initiated them and they came to the checking meetings afterwards. I said, there were three things I remember. One is I had the clearest mind you could imagine. It was so clear that there wasn't any intellectual concept or thing that to learn that I couldn't easily do. I never felt that way before. I never felt, you know, that my mind was able to perceive anything, no matter what, how, you know, complicated it was or anything like that. The other thing was, is that I had this kind of energy that was undisturbing, and that's to say the least, because I'd always been disturbed when I sit down and settle down and be quiet. I'd always feel like I needed to jump up, you know, and watch television, or was I missing something, or was there somebody visiting or something like that. And I never had that comfort of just really going deeply. Now, when I lived in Paris, I did have that seclusion, but in school it never seemed to be that I had that. And so I just had that. And I knew that I could learn anything. I didn't matter whether it was chemistry or mathematics or anything, that I would know it 100%. So, but the most important was the third thing. And that was something that is hard to describe unless people have experienced it, and they all did when they started meditation. And that was, I felt fulfilled. I felt that my heart was full. I felt that my energy was full. I felt that I could do what was right in life, because I didn't have to go out for something that I needed for enjoyment or for pleasure. I wasn't driven by desperation in any way anymore. I was in fullness. And from fullness, I could think, what would be the best thing to do? And then I would get the answer. So in this case, I said, you know, of course I'm going to stay here in India. Of course I'm going to be a sannyasi. Of course I'm going to wear orange. Of course all this and this and that. And, you know, and of course I'm not going to go back to college, because college is taught by ignorant people, and, you know, they try to tell you things of psychology and stuff like that. It's all messed up. And so how can I learn from them, you know? But in this state, I thought, it doesn't matter. You know, I know reality, and I'm fulfilled. So all that matters is I do the right thing. And I thought, well, what could be the right thing? And I think, well, what do your parents want? I thought of my parents. And they would like you to get a college education. Well, all right, but that might disappoint Maharshi. I know, you know, he knows I'm on this path and everything. So I literally almost ran into his little house. It was I did like the home plate slide when I got to his bed, so that actually my nose was quite close to his nose when I asked him the question. But I sort of was overshadowed a little bit by the discovery that my dharma was to go to school. Now, when Marshy made that tape that you heard, and he said, just whispering one word, I think, was that on the tape, that his whole mind was changed or something? There's a couple of tapes where he talks about it. Okay, so that's why it was good to see that, because that's what happened. My way of thinking changed, and I was on my dharma. You know, the flag of India, the wheel of dharma. It's all important. The dharma is your path to enlightenment, and it's so important that it's even on their flag. It's their main thing on the flag, the wheel of dharma. So understanding that for the first time in a really meaningful way, and that was it. I just said that I should go to, what do you think, Marcy, if I go to school? You know, I was a little bit out of breath. I'd sort of been excited about my discovery. And Marcy goes, and he sort of leans back because he's so close, you know, and goes, that would be very good. And I thought, oh, he didn't give me the recluse mantra, and I'm really happy he didn't, because I could see my path in front of me like that. So that was how he changed my whole way of thinking. And believe me, I mean, I could talk to you for a long time, but I know time is short. So I just wanted to say that he tried to talk to me for 3 months about getting a householder technique. Or actually, it wasn't a householder technique. It was a student technique. You know, there's like in all the advanced techniques and things like that, and you know what you'll find out as you go along, is there's techniques that suit your time, that's perfect for you. And these people that teach these advanced techniques, they know exactly what you need at that time. And they know your level of development, so what sort of sophistication you can handle and what sort of influence you need like that. So they're wonderful things. And so that's what... Where was I? I got lost too. Anyway,
you were going back to school.
Yeah, I was going back to school, and so I didn't know for all the world that I was so entrenched that for those 3 months, Marcy would speak so, you know, sweetly about the householder way and the recluse way. And he would tell me in very clear language that there were two paths. And I would always think, yes, I'm the recluse. You know, I was thinking about the horrible. I came from California, from Beverly Hills and things like that. It was just like awful place, you know. And I was thinking, yes, I'm a recluse. You know, I'll never go back, you know. And after I was reached that level of strength and fulfillment, it was so obvious that I just needed to go back to college and that I could handle it. I could handle anything. I could handle, whereas I'd spent 12 years wasting my time in high school, now I could go ahead and get, and I did. I went, actually, I was a guy that they barely graduated from high school, and it wasn't because I was stupid. They all loved me and I was funny and everything, but I just wouldn't do it. I just wouldn't do any of the work. And so when I got back to college, I mean, to me, the periodic chart of the chemicals, you know, of the atoms going across of all the different forms of matter, that was like the Vedas to me. It was so beautiful, and I fell in love with every course that I took. I fell in love with, and, you know, I loved all the mathematics and everything that I never did before. I loved philosophy and history and you know, English and so on. So it was Marcy's doing that I was the top of the dean's list. I didn't even know what a dean's list was. I thought it was like you were in trouble or something. So when the guy told me, one of my friends, one of his schoolmates, said he was looking at this bulletin board that was behind glass at the administration building, he said, "Peter, look, you're at the top of the dean's list," you know, and I said, "Well, I didn't do anything wrong, you know." So that was the power of the TM. Was it didn't make me go further and further away from my life and my fulfillment and so on and my dharma, but it actually changed my thinking very powerfully. That's Vedic science. That's real Vedic science, because everything that I've been given by Maharshi and so on, going to the yagyas, going to these things, going, you know, being with the pundits and so on. Everything's been so powerful and such a gift. So you know, so tremendous. And I've just been ready for it. And just, it's just been like, we have so much here at this university. We have such potential for fulfillment, for living that Anandamaya, that finest level of Prakriti, just before. There's nothing subtler. There's nothing beyond that except for the Absolute, which is undifferentiated. So there's no thing beyond Anandamaya. And so that's enough said, I think. Huh? Is there time for questions or what's?
If there are questions, maybe Karen could chant also, and we could meditate. Katie, yes.
Well, I was wondering, where did you learn to yoga?
You know, nature organizes so beautifully. I was doing Zen Buddhism with the leader of all Zen Buddhism of Japan. He was an old man, and he was Roshi Yamada. And my brother discovered that, this is my older brother, that living next door to us in this very nice area in the Riviera, just in between Brentwood and the Palisades, was a man that had spent his life with Yogananda. And with him were these beautiful women that were that had been Yogananda's secretaries, and they were just absolutely full of light. And they taught us asanas and... No, Dhyamata was in the main organization.
Oh, okay.
And that would have been Mount Washington. And I did see her. She came to visit Anandamayi Maa in India, mm-hmm. So I saw her then. But this was Bob Raymer, and he was very close to Yogananda and became a teacher. And he was also close to Maharshi, and I didn't know that.
Okay.
But there was two courses that were given that were kind of international courses in Catalina, and he had attended both of those and was sort of negotiating with Maharshi to maybe take over that organization. Where are we now? I forget again.
Well, we were Yogananda.
Oh, yeah.
Yoga.
Yeah.
Beverly Hills. Sin City.
What I call, yeah, but never mind. But it was great to be with Ma, and it was great to be a perfect brahmachari, to live with all the energy going upwards and so on. And, you know, it was beautiful to be in bliss. And I can say that the best way to be good in life, to be really good, is not to try, but to be. And the nature of being is bliss. So you have your ups and downs in life, you know. Everybody does. But it isn't a big deal if you have bliss on your side, because then you'll just choose naturally. Maharshi, when we became lecturers and checkers before we were teachers in California, and we go around to different universities and we give lectures, and the kids, they loved it. The university students just loved it. And we'd have like five of us sitting on the stage, and, you know, and we were all different looking people and everything, but they loved hearing about expanding the mind and everything. It was huge. Hundreds of people. I remember going out of the center in Galey, 415 Galey, and the head of Mother Divine was our secretary at the time, and she was just saying, you should check and see how many people are out there, you know. Seems like a lot of people came to start TM. And so, you know, I walked out, and there was everybody holding their trays of fruits and flowers, and they went all the way back to the alley in Galey, you know. And then I thought, oh, that's a lot of people. I said, we're going to be initiating for a long time. It was just Jerry and Debbie and I think maybe Beulah Smith or something like that. We had this suite of offices. But then I turned the thing and I looked up the alley and I thought, what, this line goes all the way up the alley. And so I walked up and I was like, you have everything you need, yeah, and you're ready yet, and okay. So going up there and you fill out your form, yeah, good. And then I looked up over the hill and the over a hill in Westwood, and the line went over the hill. So people loved it, and we used to go out and talk, you know, give lectures and stuff like that. I don't know why I brought that up, but it was just so exciting in those days because it seemed like so many people had just been born in this world to find this, and they wanted to, and many of them, you know, became leaders, they became teachers, they became leaders of the movement, they're the faculty, they're the thing. And these people, it seemed to me, I hope it doesn't seem presumptuous or anything, but I just feel that they came to this world just like you have. That's why it's kind of like a family reunion. And it just came to this world to be with Maharshi and with the teaching and, you know, the children and the parents and everything. So my parents started. It was the farthest thing from their, you know, culture, really. But they saw how, you know, Keith was the number one student in physics at UCLA, and I was on the dean's list, and we were very polite, and we were very kind to our parents, and they had to start. And then they met Maharshi. It was all over. They just started. And my dad, he was born a long time ago. He was born in 1893. And he never quite got Maharshi's name. He used to call him Maharaji. But he loved meditation. And I remember when he was on his deathbed in the hospital, and I sort of was just sitting with him, and I said, "Dad, do you meditate? Have you been meditating?" And he goes, it's wonderful. It's just wonderful." And that was a man that didn't open up very often, you know, to things like that. But he was, you know, it really was a great thing for him. So who knows? Maybe one of our grandchildren is born again as him or something like that. I don't know. We have this great family, the Wallaces, Ted Wallace and Gareth Wallace. They all have children now. My kids all have children, and so who knows? We should have some chanting, huh?
Yeah. So Karen, why don't you come up? We always finish the morning. Sit here. We always finish the morning with some recitation and meditation. We'll do that today too.
She's my teacher. She's teaching me Sanskrit, which I learned when I was probably about 19 or something like that, and then forgot. So she's trying to pick up the pieces.
Okay, so let's close the eyes.
In 5 minutes, 7 minutes.
Yeah.
श्रीमद् भगवद् गीता प्रथमोऽध्यायः धृतराष्ट्र उवाच धर्मक्षेत्रे कुरुक्षेत्रे समवेतायुयुत्सवः मामका पाण्डवाश्चैव किमकुर्वत सञ्जय सञ्जय उवाच दृष्ट्वा तु पाण्डवानीकं व्यूढं दुर्योधनस्तदा आचार्यमुपसङ्गम्य राजा वचनमब्रवीत् पश्यैतां पाण्डुपुत्राणामाचार्यमहतीं च मु व्यूढान्द्रुपदपुत्रेण तव शिष्येन धीमता अत्र शूरा महेश्वासा भीमार्जुनसमायुधि युयुधानो विराटश्च द्रुपदश्च महारथः दृष्टके